children, including the elderly, the physically and mentally disabled. The significance, in my opinion, of the mapping project lies in its ability to show us how Zionism, an ideology, can materialise within an institution. To those that are hearing this word Zionism for the first time, Zionism is the belief that Jews, no matter where they reside, have the historic right to reside in Palestine, whereby they receive more rights than the indigenous Palestinians that have resided there for generations. So the mapping project, as David Miller has said, echoing his words, is very important in understanding the nodes, the corporations, as well as the institutions that support Israel's ongoing occupation in Palestine.
I mean, David, do you think this attempt to make Zionist organisations and their activities more visible is likely to encourage or discourage the you know, the pro-Palestinian movement?
Well, there's two sides to this. On the one hand, we can't effectively campaign against pro-Israel groups if we don't know who they are. So it's fundamental that we understand that there are pro-Israel groups throughout this country, throughout Massachusetts, throughout the whole of the US, and indeed all over the world. But we don't really usually have any awareness of them. In this country, there are literally thousands of Zionist and pro-Israel organizations. Now, no one in this country can name them all. There's far too many of them. But once you start to name them, you start to say these organizations live at this address, they are funded by these other people, they have this much money, this is what they do, then people can start to say, well, is that right? I didn't realize that was happening. So it's fundamental to campaigning against Zionism in this country, which, of course, is a fundamental prop to the occupation of Palestine over there. But on the other hand, what's said by some people in the movement, and we saw that in some of the film, is that, well, this is too close to home. These organizations have Jewish in the name, and we shouldn't really be targeting those organizations because it could result in Jews being targeted. Well, you know, on the contrary, this is not about Jews. It's about pro-Israel organizations, and it's about the politics which they pursue. Any organization which pursues pro-Israel politics, whether it's got the word Jewish in its title or not, is fair game for the pro-Palestinian movement. And that seems to me to be the key thing here, that these organizations have to be understood and known about in order for us to target them.
I mean, why do you think like the Palestinian youth movement and organisations like, you know, Samidun have come out in support of the project? I mean, what's the motivation behind them doing that, do you think?
We must look at these movements themselves, the entities of these movements, what are they made up and the purpose? When we look at Palestinian youth movement as an example, it is a transnational movement made up of members from the Palestinian diaspora. Those very same members will carry out projects and campaigns designed to support and call for the human rights belonging to the Palestinian people. As history has shown, one of the biggest threats to such campaigns has been the Israeli lobby. By understanding the connections that the Israeli lobby have, for instance, within Boston, and the relationships they have with other cultural academic institutions, betters the individuals within PYM, betters the individuals within the Samadul network in terms of understanding the political climate in which they operate in, and so how to hold Israel effectively accountable.
I wonder, David, as well, whether you could say anything about the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, have they been involved in trying to undermine this mapping project? And perhaps just say a little bit about what the Anti-Defamation League actually is for our viewers.
Well, the ADL has been involved. We saw a little bit of that in the film. They are central to all of the campaigns against the Palestine Solidarity Movement. They were set up almost 100 years ago now by an organisation called B'nai B'rith, which is remains a global Israel lobby group and is formerly part of the Zionist movement. And it was set up to target anti-Semitism. It's the Anti-Defamation League. So it's against the defamation of the Jewish people, that is anti-Semitism. But very, very early on, in the 1930s, and certainly by the 40s, even before the creation of Israel, it was spying on Arab-American groups, including nascent Palestinian groups, and giving information about them to the FBI. Then, since that period, has collaborated over the decades with the FBI, has been involved in spying on all sorts of activist groups, including anti-apartheid activists in relation to South Africa. And so this is a spying organisation. It collaborates regularly and routinely, as the declassified FBI files show, with Mossad. Indeed, collaborated with the forerunner of Mossad before the creation of the State of Israel. And so it's effectively Israel's cat's paw in the US. And of course it condemns any sign of pro-Palestinian activism as anti-Semitism, because that is the weapon of choice of the State of Israel in its foreign policy objectives. just accuse all of our critics of being anti-Semites. And that's what that's the weapon they've developed over the last 20 years, and it's at the forefront of their repertoire.
Yeah. I mean, Ibrahim, I mean, perhaps you could say a little bit about some of the organisations that have been identified in this mapping project, and also tell us, you know, why is it important that we know about them?
So let's take three organisations that were identified within the Boston Mapping Project: Elbit Systems, the Ruderman Family Foundation, and, as David Miller has mentioned, the Anti-Defamation League. When we look at Elbit Systems, for those that are unaware, Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest private arms companies. They create the drones that are used to survey and attack Palestinians. They market their weapons as battlefield tested. Now, I'll ask you, Chris, the question, who are they battlefield tested on? Was it on the 66 children that were murdered within an 11-day period that took place in the month of May in 2021, or the 39 women that also too were murdered? Another organisation worth mentioning is the Ruderman Family Foundation. The Ruderman Family Foundation, despite also making sizable donations to Zionist organisations, Shira Ruderman is on the board of the Friends of the IDF. The IDF were responsible for capturing the lives of at least 500 children within one summer in 2014, specifically in Gaza. Lastly, the organisation also worth mentioning is the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League have worked multiple times to quell any form of Palestinian activism that is taking place within America. In Boston in 2018, in Boston in 2021, they attempted to limit any form of pro-support, whatever we may find towards the Palestinians. It's also worth mentioning that in 2018, we saw the Great March of Return happening in Gaza, where paramedics such as Razan al-Najjar, journalists such as Yasser Murtaja, as well as children such as Ahmed Mseba Abu Tayyur, were murdered by an Israeli sniper. In 2021, as we already mentioned, we saw at least 260 Palestinians murdered within an 11-day period.
Yes.
So when we look at the role played by the Anti-Defamation League, it is clear that within both years they have attempted to silence any form of Palestinian activism. But in addition to that, they have also been responsible for passing anti-BDS, or at least attempting to try and pass anti-BDS resolutions within the state of Massachusetts. Yeah. So it is fundamental that we know what these organizations are in order for us to hold them accountable to their connections with Israel's occupation.
Notwithstanding the attack by the Zionist movement against the mapping project, do you think it's another indication of the growing strength of the worldwide resistance against Zionism that a mapping project like that has actually been formed?
I do. I think that it's a new front, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that the Palestine solidarity movement in this country, in the US and other places, has tended to focus on what's happening in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, the human rights abuses, the murders, the discrimination, the ethnic cleansing. And that's right, we should focus on that. But they've been reluctant to focus on the way in which those activities are supported in the US and in the UK by the infrastructure of Zionism. And so it seems to me that we don't liberate Palestine only by liberating Palestine in Palestine, but also by removing the props which allow the occupation to continue. And they are the Zionist organizations which exist. So the fact that we've now got something like the mapping program project in Massachusetts, and there are other similar projects underway elsewhere, is the beginning of showing the public in these countries what the Zionists are up to, and therefore the beginning of bringing that to an end.
Mm. Well, let's just pause there for a moment. Well-grounded research underlying the mapping project.
The mapping project stands accused, including from supposed allies, of targeting Jewish groups, even of potentially endangering teenagers. But are any of these charges valid, or do they simply provide a clarifying moment, revealing weak, confused allies who objectively side with the forces of Zionist oppression? Let's look at the worst of the allegations. Zionist groups like the Union of Jewish Students, UJS, which is formally affiliated in the Zionist movement, have typically lied about the project. UJS President Joel Rosen tweeted that the project's targets included an organization for Jews with disability, the Harvard Center for Jewish Studies, the Jewish Arts Collaborative, and the Jewish Teen Foundation. Similar criticisms were made by supposed allies of boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Zionism. Ariel Gold wrote that the project literally targets Jewish teen and youth organization, We should all fear a massacre of Jewish youth as a result. A massacre of Jewish youth? For mentioning that a group with the word Jewish in its title defends the crimes of Zionism, the absurdity is extraordinary. But what is the link between these groups and Zionism? Well, the Jewish Teen Foundation of Greater Boston is a Zionist group. Run as a project of the Hebrew colleges, which specifically states it's rooted in the Zionist movement. It's financially supported by Zionist foundations and run propaganda sessions to radicalize young people to support the racist ideology of Zionism, as in this event in May 2021. Or take the Jewish Arts Collaborative, which promotes the Zionist entity and whitewashes the reality of the subjugation of the Palestinians. As well as Zionist funders, it is directly funded by the Israel consulate to pretend that hummus and falafel are Israeli cuisine. What about the Harvard Center for Jewish Studies? Not only does it attempt to provide specific legitimacy to the mythological underpinnings of Zionism and has ties to Israeli universities complicit in the occupation, it also maintains connections to the Zionist student group Hillel and the extremist sect Chabad. Overall, the mapping project is performing an extremely useful service in making visible the hidden connection of the groups in the US with the crimes of the occupation regime. The sooner it's rolled out all over the world, the sooner it will be able to contribute significantly to the liberation of Palestine. The sooner we will be able to dismantle all Zionist organizations, every single one.
David, the arguments used against the project seem to be drawn from the same playbook that was used against your analysis of Zionism, don't they? I mean, what do you think is going on here?
Well, we know what's going on. This is not just what happens when there's a controversy emerges. This is a global playbook developed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry for Strategic Affairs in Israel. I mean, they roll out their strategies amongst their groups. The groups are all coordinated, and they learn from each other on what to do. So what you do when someone criticises a group with the word Jewish in its title is you say, oh, it's just a Jewish group. Mm. It's not a Zionist group, except, of course, when you look at its constitution, you find it is a Zionist group, as we saw in the case there of the Hebrew College, which, you know, openly states that it's rooted in the Zionist movement. Yes, of course it is. Yeah. These are Zionist organizations. Let's be clear about that. They're not organizations for the whole of the Jewish community. They're for a specific political tendency within the Jewish community, which is a racist tendency, mm-hmm. which depends for its very existence on the ethnic cleansing, the continued occupation and ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Mm-hmm. So this is a playbook. We're being played here. And people shouldn't be fooled into thinking, oh, these people might be upset because we call them Zionists. They're proud of being Zionists. Mm. They're proud of it. And we should be proud of pointing out that they're Zionists, and that's a racist ideology.
No, indeed. And also, when you point out some of the interconnections, global interconnections, you're often accused, or one is often accused, of indulging in conspiracy theories, aren't you? I mean, it's...
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, there's no acknowledgement that actually research... is a legitimate activity
Indeed.
Of social
Indeed.
Scientists. I used to be a full-time social scientist before they sacked me.
Yeah.
No conception of that at all. They instead want to say, oh, it's our Jewish right to have a fond feeling for Zionism. Mm. Well, you know, that's okay. Have a fond feeling for the Zionism in your heart, but the actually existing Zionist movement, that must be ended.
Indeed. Abraham, how do you respond to those that say, well, you know, kind of projects like this encourage attacks on Jewish people?
The American Jewish Committee in 2021 recently released an article whereby they questioned American Jews in terms of the threat of anti-Semitism. Where does it come from? Does it come from the left or does it come from the right? And nine out of 10 respondents said that the attacks on anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic attacks carried out in America, tend to come from the far right by majority. Not from the BDS campaigners, not from the left, not saying that it doesn't happen, but by majority... it is carried out by far-right neo-Nazi groups. And one thing that we must make evidently clear is that the mapping project was not created with the intention to map Jewish institutions and organizations. Majority of the institutions and organizations mapped in the Boston mapping project are non-Jewish organizations. Mm. As David Miller said, it is these organizations that have ties to Zionism. This is not an attack towards Jews as a result of their religion, but more... preparing the information that we need towards challenging Zionism in order to uproot its occupation in Palestine.
Mm. I mean, what do you think this says, David, about the unity of the struggle against Zionism, this sort of mapping project?
Well, I think it's, I mean, it shows that there is a sort of infrastructure of Zionism, that the Zionist movement has its own infrastructure around the world, especially in the US and in the UK, but many other countries too. But also, the interesting new thing I think that it shows is the intersection of the Zionist movement with other institutions of US imperialism, as they put it, but also other oppressive domestic institutions in the US. I mean, the most obvious one, which is in the project, is the connections between the Anti-Defamation League and the local police forces. Now, of course, this became a big issue, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement and George Floyd, where it became apparent that many of the police forces engaged in killing black people on the streets had been getting training or advice from Zionist groups, including the ADL, but not limited to the ADL. No. So there is, of course, those particular questions as well. And it's a question of how different sorts of oppression are actually, in the end, linked together. And that's a really very interesting and useful part of the project.
No, indeed. And I understand that, Ibrahim, you've been working and looking at Zionism within the Goethe Institute recently. I mean, what did you find?
Well, to those unaware, the Goethe Institute is seen as somewhat the cultural arm of the Federal Republic of Germany. The Goethe Institute has recently signed an initiative alongside 30 other cultural organizations condemning the BDS movement, specifically saying, quote unquote, "We reject the BDS boycott of Israel." The Goethe Institute, who is expected to invite British Iraqi rapper Loki, as well as Palestinian activist Mohammed Al-Qaid, cancelled their performances. What we see in the Goethe Institute is nothing new, however, this anti-BDS trajectory that we're seeing throughout German society. In 2019, the Bundestag had signed a resolution titled Resisting BDS, which condemned German public bodies from providing funds to organizations that are calling for the boycott, divestment and sanctions against Israel, who was recently regarded and seen as an apartheid state carrying out apartheid against the Palestinian people by Amnesty International. But we must understand, when we look at such initiatives, when we look at such attitudes accelerating, we see the Zionist, that we see a pro-Zionist agenda being pushed more and more throughout German society. Yeah. We see it happening not only on a localized level, but also on a top-down level. This empowers us to, again, understand the type of political climate in which we operate in and how to, again, effectively challenge Israel's occupation as a member of the diaspora.
Indeed. Well, thanks very much indeed, Ibrahim, for your contribution today. And thank you, David. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as unfortunately we're out of time. But thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. While on that note, we have with us in our studio today Mr. Salman Naqvi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and an Islamic researcher in the Hafza Almi of Qum. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, brother, in our previous session, we discussed about psychomotor skills, and the most important thing was parents need to get educated themselves before they are educating something to their child. Even they are, when they are feeding their children, they need to have proper information about the diet they are giving to their children, about the nutrition, about the amount of carbohydrates, proteins, fats, vitamins, minerals, and all that. And apart from that, you said whatever a mother does during her pregnancy has a definite impact on the baby who is in the womb. And that's why we may have in Islam that a pregnant woman should remain in ablution all the time, and she should recite as much as possible the Holy Quran and then many other recommendations that we have. Well, we have been generally talking about the domains of behavior and the relationships. Do we have anything left in those behavior?
Yes, I begin in the name of Allah Almighty, the Supreme Absolute Being. Yes, we were talking about the domains of behavior, the classification of behavior. So we talked about a few examples which are related to the behavior one has with oneself.
Yes.
In relation to managing behavior with oneself. So we said we were talking about the management and maintenance and development of the resources and the faculties which have been given to us by Allah Almighty,
yeah,
which are under our control. And in contrast to that, we have things which are not in our control. For example, time management. We need to teach our children how to manage their time.
Okay.
And of course, as I said, basically one of the principles that we all we have to follow throughout is that we have to set an example ourselves.
Yeah.
We want the child to take care of his mental and physical health. We should be doing it on ourselves and be leading by example. We should expect the child to follow us in taking care of our health, physical, mental.
And I mean, as well as emotional state.
And emotional, of course, temperament, attitude, all of this comes from this emotional and emotional aspect of our existence. And if we are not well-tempered ourselves, well-mannered ourselves, how do we expect our child to be?
Okay, so do so you that, mean this to say
one
like
of the golden
I,
principles is that we have to lead by example.
Do you mean to say if I, as a child, see my mother depressed, see my father like angry, curious, that all has impact on my development?
Of course.
Okay.
So I need to take so the mental health we have to take care of. We will talk about extensively in the future how to manage, how to learn, make a child learn to develop his mental health.
Okay.
We just gave an example that, for example, starting from the womb at a later stage, reading books and solving problems, issues.
Okay.
Physical health, being allowed to play about, let his energies flow, not to suppress them. I mean, many parents don't want their children to be making a lot of noise in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So what can they do? Especially in our day, in our today's time and environment, we have small apartments where we are living in. So we expect our children to remain quiet. We are suppressing their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want them to become good, mannered and tempered people in the future,
mm-hmm.
they have to be allowed to express their feelings.
Explore, yeah.
And
explore
they,
and express.
They need to be inquisitive. They should be able to question. They should be look curious. They should be allowed to question you.
Yes.
If you want them to be cognitively
developed mature.
You need to be to allow them to that to promote that.
Curiosity. You need to act as a stimulus, basically, as a, for
exactly.
their growth.
Curiosity is built in human beings. You have to allow that to expand and develop.
Yeah. And how can we do that? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We think, how can you manage mental development, emotional development, and physical development in your children as parents? Yes, brother.
Yes, so basically, we as a parent have to know about this. We have to explore ourselves, all the possible behaviors that are there out there which have to be learned.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a bigger picture in our minds. We're not just talking about mental health, we're talking about physical health. In mental health, we're talking about intellectual health. When we're talking about a child should be able to find out the truth.
Okay.
And to when he has found out the truth, he should be able to accept the truth.
Okay.
So that is also important. So many times...
So we have to develop the ability to research.
To research, to understand, to explore.
And to reach a certain conclusion.
And then
able to adopt and accept
And accept
that.
It.
Yeah.
Accepting the truth is very important. Many times we know the truth is out there. We know what it is, but we are not ready to accept it.
Of course.
It's the difference between
knowing and accepting and having
faith in them.
Having belief in
them. I mean, so many of the kuffar, they knew the truth.
Yes.
Even accepted the truth in the sense that they said, yes, we accept that. They didn't have faith because basically there was something inside them which was stopping them from doing
which
that.
Which has not, that has become a hindrance or obstacle in their faith.
So that's at a higher level. But even in daily affairs, we have so many quarrels, quarreling and conflicts in between human beings.
Yes.
And it starts from childhood.
Yes.
In childhood, quarrels and conflicts are not a big deal. But when one grows up and he's not able to manage this issue.
Now he has to manage.
We have so many political issues, so many political fighting and quarreling. We have religious issues. Where does that stem from? Because people are either not able to understand what the truth is.
Yes.
And once they know, they are not ready to accept it.
Okay. So it gets back to the same thing.
So we have to, at the very in the level of the childhood, we have to be able to create that mental capacity,
mm-hmm.
intellectually and emotionally, so that children, they have to see us. When we as parents, for example, we have a debate over something,
mm-hmm.
at the end we end it amicably and say, yes, I accept your point of view. You have made a very good argument. I accept that argument. Or the other way around.
Yes.
Or even if we are not ready to, I can't understand what you're saying, but I respect your views.
Yes.
We agree to disagree.
Okay.
So if that attitude is developed by ourselves as parents, then the child will learn to do that.
Child will definitely kind of develop into a kind of a hypocritic being because he's saying at the same time, I agree, and at the same time, he disagrees. So that's a hypocrisy.
That's an amicable way of conflict resolution. Of course, when I say we agree to differ, but we're respecting each other's point of view.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, one has to take the decision. The parent, the father has to be the leader.
Yes.
But the conflict resolution is done in a very amicable way. There's no quarreling. There's no mudslinging. They're not abusing each other.
Accept your point of view without a fight or a quarrel.
Without a fight or a quarrel.
I'll be talking to you on that note after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're seeing how you can help your child in conflict resolution without a fight or quarreling.
So that needs intellectual capacities,
mm-hmm.
developing of the way how to argue, how to develop an argument, how to try to communicate your point of view. And then if you're not able...
For example, in certain societies, we have fathers who are dominant, who have a dominant nature, and they, by force, make something accept their wives, or like when a child sees his mother accepting something as force, as like under quarrels and as a dominant thing, maybe he develops with the same quality.
Yes. I mean, in societies, in traditional societies, we say the father plays the
main and embodied role.
It's true. Islam accepts that because he is supposed to be the head of the family. But the head of the family can't enforce things.
Yes.
He cannot force things. He has to enforce his opinion if it is correct, but he has to be able to communicate what he means. And he wants to develop an environment where they accept based on logic and reasoning.
He has to bring about reasons, logic.
Even when we go up to a higher level of society, when we're talking about the leadership at the top, the imam, the leadership concept of wilaya.
Yeah.
Even at that level, the Holy Prophet is commanded by Allah Almighty to have a consultation with his colleagues and his companions.
Yeah.
وَشَابِرْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ Consult them in those issues which are there in society, which you need to enforce Islamic laws and values about them. But how to do it? Consult with your...
Okay, so even if as a father you're the head of the family, you need to consult.
You need to consult. You need to develop that ability in the child, especially when,
You consult in front of a child, he gets that self-importance.
Exactly. I mean, in the first place, he sees the father doing it with the mother, talking to her, consulting with her.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the imam at the top level is also commanded by Allah Almighty. وَشَاوِرْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلَ اللَّهِ You consult, make a decision, and then have faith and have faith in Allah Almighty. Trust Allah Almighty with your decision.
All these things should go in line.
So, I mean, the consultation is a way of giving them importance.
Okay.
Developing their abilities. Feel that they are participating in the decision-making process.
Helping them.
And then at the end, the decision-taking is by the head.
Yes.
So that also comes down to this basic unit of society, that is the family.
Yes.
So if we want to develop a society based on wilaya,
yes,
one of the very important aspects is consultation and participation of the whole society
that
in that
comes
decision.
Down to family.
So it comes to the family also. It has to start there. The mental development, the physical and the intellectual and emotional development has to start there.
Yes. Thank you so much. That was really a great discussion. That was really helpful. And we really had some important and new things to learn. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, you have any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on these social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also download our programs on our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
If I cannot act like Malik al-Ashtar will, it is good if I can get close to how he was, and I am hopeful that our country will become an Islamic one, that our youth become Muslims and devoted to Islam. The second command of Allah, the Blessed and Exalted, to Prophet Moses is remind them of the days of Allah. All days belong to Allah, but certain days have special characteristics because of which they become the days of Allah. The day on which the noble prophet migrated to Medina is the day of Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Shiism. In one of his speeches, he said that those who claim that they are the Shia or the true followers of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam and follow him should follow him in words, actions, writing, and other things. In this part of his speech, Imam Khomeini is referring to the practical aspect of when we say we are following someone, when we say we are the Shia. Obviously, the word Shia means the follower. In the Quran, we have the Shia of Musa, Shia of Ibrahim. There are different words like the followers of the Ibrahim, followers of the Musa. So the Shia word, it means that the follower. And when we are ascribing us to the Amir al-Mu'mineen, which is the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and we say that we are the follower of Imam Ali alayhi salam, it means that we must follow him in the word, in action, in writing, and in all other things. We must follow him practically. That is the summary.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
There are people who say that they are the followers of Imam Ali alayhi salam, who call themselves as the Shia. But whenever there is a practical aspect, whenever Islam needs them, we do not find them next to the Islam. You do not find them in the place where they should help Islam with their actions. For example, when other mu'mineen, other believers, they need their help, they're not helping them. Maybe financially, maybe they can support them psychologically, maybe they can just support them with the words. So practically, they should be there in order to help. For example, whenever there is a mustadhaf, there is someone who is oppressed in the world, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, Ali ibn Abi Talib, he used to raise his voice against the oppression. Therefore, his follower must also raise his voice for the oppressed ones. They should raise their voice against the oppression, against the oppressors, and they should be on the side of the oppressed ones. This is the character which we see from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. When we look at the life of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, we see that he has justice in his life. Where is the justice in our life? Therefore, we must follow him in word, action, writing, and all other things, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran-Russia relations with Russian Ambassador to Iran, Levan Jagarian. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
Iran and Russia are entering into a new strategic era in their relationship. The West's sanctions and overreactions, and its failure to isolate Russia following the war in Ukraine, has resulted in a strategic reorientation of Russia towards the East and South, which includes Iran. Iran itself is taking full advantage of a new emerging multipolar world order and declining U.S. power, and is enhancing its strategic relations with emerging powers from around the world, from China in East Asia to Venezuela in South America. After all, Iranians witnessed the failure of the JCPOA process and the failure of the nearly 30-year attempt by certain Western-oriented Iranian elites to create rapprochement with the West, only to be embarrassingly rejected by the US itself. Iran is confidently pursuing its national interests with its non-Western neighbors in Asia and friends and allies around the world, and closing the book on strategic rapprochement with the West. After a period of naivety and sophomoric false hopes about the West and America among Iranian and Russian elites in the 1990s and early 21st century, everyone in Iran and Russia has now witnessed the fundamental enmity of American and Western elites to the very existence of an independent and powerful Iran and Russia, which can effectively contain, roll back, and expel America from Eurasia as it tries to maintain its fast-fading claims to global hegemony. Iran and Russia have made a good start into this new strategic era. However, a number of issues remain to be resolved, particularly in the field of trade and economics. Once these issues are resolved and Iran and Russia sign the strategic agreement that is currently being finalized, Zbigniew Brzezinski's and America's nightmare scenario of the strategic alignment of Iran, Russia and China will be complete, moving the world faster into the post-American era of contemporary human history.
Ambassador Jagarian, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As you know, our program is more of a conversation. Yeah. We want to get into the issues in a more deep fashion. We want to talk about it more from a historic, strategic perspective. And so with that in mind, there's a lot of things we need to cover in our conversation. Well, Mr. Ambassador, it seems to me if we examine this behavior after the Cold War, we see that the West, according to the old plan from the 19th century, Halford Mackinder, talking about never allowing Russia and, for example, Germany to have good relations, always having these buffer states, one time against Russia, one time against Germany. So we see that they're effectively what they're doing is they are weaponizing the most extreme chauvinistic nationalistic elements in all the countries.
Yes, so
it's not the case that everybody in Latvia or in Estonia is like this.
Yes.
Or everybody in Ukraine. I'm talking about the Ukraine, it's not the Russian.
Of course. Sure.
So what they do is they go after the worst people, and they create an atmosphere which then causes, and all of it is to destabilize Russia. So this is
under this false, under influence of this false American propaganda, which is, I mean, circulated by Voice of America, Radio Europe, Free Europe, and BBC, so-called Correct. Independent, or as I call it, Radio Yesterday, right. from Prague, or day before yesterday, whatever, right. Iran International. And
because, as you mentioned, there are different historic understandings of what happened.
Yeah.
So they are emphasizing those issues that are always anti-Russian. They're never talking about the other issues. Yes, they're never talking about that, you know, you had people like you mentioned, the Nazis in Ukraine, joining with the Nazis to fight against their own homeland and their own people. We see people attacking Orthodox churches now.
So
these are the things that maybe, as you're mentioning, it's a propaganda issue. But don't you think Russia could do a little bit more in terms of...
And we are doing more. We try to do more. And, of course, but anyway, you know, they banned all our possibilities to work abroad. And but, you know, Russia today, Sputnik, it created a huge problem for us.
Again, you're welcome to the club.
Freedom of speech.
Exactly.
Welcome. So that's why I call them no communists. And as a former communist, I'm very happy to see a lot of new comrades.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Ambassador, very good. So let's move what we were talking about previously. So you see the future of Russia in this new... First of all, how do you see this new multipolar, this new emerging global...
Americans must forget about their dream to be to establish a unipolar world.
Right.
China, Russia, Iran, and other friendly countries will do their utmost to resist, and we are in favor of a multipolar world.
Exactly.
And it's reality. An inevitable process. No other choice.
It's interesting you mentioned that. You know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his final book, he talks about that the worst-case scenario...
Yeah.
For the Americans is a is the strategic unity between China, Russia, and Iran. He very cleverly doesn't mention India because they always want to use India as a wedge in Asia. But so it's very clear when somebody like Brzezinski talks about this, then this becomes clear to us why they are doing these things.
Sure.
So on the one side, they are pressuring Russia with Ukraine. They did it also the coup attempt in Kazakhstan, I think it was.
In January,
they're doing all these things. In West Asia, they're pressuring Iran with Israel, with all this.
Taiwan.
Of course. And in East Asia, they're pressuring China with Taiwan and with the Quad and, you know, the
AUKUS.
Because a lot of people don't realize, you know, the American troops that are in Korea, they're very close to Beijing.
South Korea.
In South Korea, exactly. In South Korea, they're very close to Beijing. This is not something that's because of the North. It's because of China. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about this new emerging strategic relationship between Iran and Russia. There's many aspects to it. It's at the beginning of it. I think it was a good start. I remember we had the trip by President Putin to Iran a number of years ago, which was a very good, successful trip, and where President Putin and the leader of the Islamic Revolution had a good meeting. President Putin gave as a present one of these old Qurans that was in Russia, which was very nice. And I believe that maybe at that point we see the beginnings of this issue, this kind of newer relationship emerging. Of course, at that time, we didn't have the issue of JCPOA. We didn't have the issue, or we had it, but it wasn't as prominent, maybe. We didn't have the issue of the problems that have occurred after the special military operation. But then with the new administration in Iran, the 13th administration, we had President Raisi going to Moscow. We had the Minister of Energy coming here. We had the recent, Russian National Day here with the Minister of Oil here also. So if you could please give us a little bit of an insight into what will it take, what is happening, and what will it take for us to get to this, inshallah, as we say again, this time where we can sign that strategic agreement as Iran signed with China, as they recently signed with Venezuela. What are the issues? What are some of the barriers? From your perspective, what do we need to do in terms of economics, security, culture, whatever it is that you think that should be mentioned here?
First of all, thanks for this very interesting and a good question. I have been serving here as ambassador for more than 10 years and a half.
Yes.
And for me, it's a big honor to represent such a great country like Russian Federation in such a great country like the Islamic Republic of Iran. You just mentioned President Putin's visit to Iran. I was witnessing and participating in this visit three times, 2015, 2017, 2018, and I was present in his meetings with His Excellency, the spiritual leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I would like to express my respect to His Excellency. And I was witnessing the very warm atmosphere, very friendly. Mm-hmm. And such good personal relations between our leaders, they are very helpful for us.
Yes.
Diplomats, high-ranking officials from both countries to fulfill all the tasks we have got, instructions from our leaders. It's very important. Now, with the 13th government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we can say that we have opened a new page on our bilateral relations. And initially, the Iranian government, President Raisi, expressed his will to develop much more relations with neighboring countries and with eastern countries. The same are for us. So we have similar goals, ideas. And you mentioned this exchange of delegations between the two countries. From the very beginning of the year in spring, a lot of Iranian high-ranking delegations visited Russian Federation. And Mr. Oji was there, Minister of Transportation was there, Mr. Rustam Qasemi, Vice President Surena Sattari was there. And finally, on the 25th of May, a huge, big Russian delegation headed by Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak visited Iran. And he had many meetings here, very fruitful. And he was accompanied by six vice ministers of different ministries, economic, financial, transportation, atomic. And we will continue our consultations on different levels to develop our fruitful cooperation and mutual interests. I'm very, very, very optimistic. In autumn this year, we will hold the next session of our Joint Economic Commission in the Russian Federation. Now it's our turn to host it. I do believe that it will open new prospects for our bilateral relations. Last year, the volume of our trade was $4 billion. It's nothing.
Yeah.
Taking into consideration our capabilities, it's nothing. I mentioned $4 billion, but we will do our utmost.
Yes.
To remove U.S. dollars from our bilateral trade, not only with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we'll do our utmost to use as much as possible our national currencies,
yes,
which is very important. And we will help us to bypass all these sanctions, illegitimate sanctions. But in terms of sanctions, they have imposed sanctions against Russia, but it was for the first time against Soviet Union. Jackson Vanik.
Yes.
But we will never ask them, please lift the sanctions. It's up to them. If they want to lift sanctions, they are welcome. If they don't want to lift the sanctions, we will impose counter-sanctions. Sanctions, counter-sanctions. Sanctions, counter-sanctions. It is a lose-lose game. But it's up to them to decide.
Mr. Ambassador, it's interesting you mentioned the trade. We had one of our guests in the previous programs, in one of our previous episodes in this program, we had Professor Sergei Glazyev, who is a famous Russian economist. He was also advisor, I believe, to the presidency. And he very nicely and very technically explained that they are working in Russia on a plan to have a international trade currency to replace the dollar.
Yes, yes, yes.
Not to replace the national currencies. In fact, the national currencies can be the backing of this international trade currency. Again, something that is proposed by Russian academics. And also using the vast natural resources of Eurasia, of Russia, Iran, China, and other countries who want to join as a backing for this to replace the dollar. So, this issue that Iran has been talking about for years, because we understood the difficulty of being living under this dollar hegemony and not being able to, you know, do the most basic things.
Unfortunately.
Yes, and we had recently also an interview with Professor Duhan from the UN. She's from Belarus.
Yes.
Talking about one of the main things in her report was the fact that this banking sanctioning and the sanctioning of and needing to use the dollar is an issue. So, in other words, what I want to hear from you, maybe if you can say it very clearly or very without, you know. So the goal or the plan for the Russian Federation is to move away from the dollar.
Yes. Yeah. We want to remove dollar. We try to our utmost to do that. But it's their initiative.
Right.
Yeah. They decided to steal our money.
Exactly.
As well as they decided to steal your oil.
Exactly.
Don't surprise.
So this ruins their own credibility because nobody then trusts putting the money in those banks.
Yes. No trust.
So this is they shot themselves in the foot, as they say.
Yes, yes.
They shouldn't have
I'm sorry, that. You mentioned the issue of treaty between Russia and Iran.
Yes.
We've got the draft last year.
The strategic agreement.
Yes, we work on it, but it's a little bit long process, but we will try to speed it up because we must ask the opinion of Russian different ministries,
exactly.
Inside foreign ministry, outside foreign ministry. It's also always on the agenda of our bilateral contacts. And last time when Mr. Amir Abdullahian, foreign minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran, talked to his Russian colleague, Mr. Sergei Lavrov, he also touched upon the issue, and we are working on it very hardly, and we are in regular contacts with our Iranian friends.
It's interesting you mentioned that. We had another interview. I'm sorry I keep mentioning other interviews, but about Russia, we had actually quite a few interesting interviews, both with Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian. In the interview, you also mentioned the relationship with Russia, but also with former Iranian ambassador, Mr. Sajjadi, who was a former Iranian ambassador in Russia. And he, because he's worked on this issue a lot, he talked about that the Iranian and Russian economies are very complementary to each other. On the one hand, we have a very powerful oil and energy sector that the cooperation could literally change the entire global energy markets if there's a cooperation. In terms of technology, both countries very advanced in these areas, not necessarily needing the West to give them any technology, and there could be a lot of things. In terms of security, we talked a little bit about this. I think this is something that we don't mention enough, but it's good if we mention it, that we had a very successful security and military cooperation in Syria.
Yeah. Yes.
That, you know, we have to say this. Iran and Russia defeated the Takfiris.
Thanks to us.
To the terrorists, together.
Thanks together.
Yes.
Russian and Iranians,
exactly.
First of all.
Exactly. This is something, you know, because we have this problem in Iran. I wanted to also get your opinion on this, that we have this old tradition in Iran of anti-Russian.
Yes, I know. I know it very well.
Yes, you
know. I feel it.
Of course, there is a history for a lot of Iranians as it relates to the Tsarist Russian era,
yes,
as it relates to the Soviet Union. These are not things that we are denying. Just so that people who are listening know for sure, my great-grandfather was killed in the war with the Russians. So it's not something most Iranian families have these issues. But the issue is that Russia is different. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not the Tsarist Russian era. But we still see that there is any excuse that they can use, whether it's, you know, the Minister of Oil standing this way, or you standing there.
I'm standing this way.
Yeah, exactly.
Or this way.
Exactly. Is there something, do you think, that is the Russian Federation, is the Russian embassy, what should we do to work on this issue? And I'm saying this, you know, connecting it with this very successful year-long cooperation that we had, where we gave a lot of... sorry, I need to mention this. This idea, for example, Shahid Soleimani, General Soleimani. So one of the things that he did in Syria is he led the operation to free the Russian pilot himself as the commanding general.